This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Cayucas, California. Come along and join me as we visit with author and visionary Franz Wisner. You've written a book, Honeymoon with My Brother, a bestseller. Tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, not how my wedding was supposed to go, but starting with the fact that my fiance didn't show up, and this is days before the wedding. We're going to get married up in Sea Ranch, California. You know Sea Ranch?
Sure.
Northern California, gorgeous place.
This isn't fiction.
This is not fiction, sad to say. And a beautiful place, but it's the kind of place where you need to rent cabins months in advance and bring in food and wine from the Napa Valley. And we had 150 people going to this wedding. And then just a couple days before the big event, she says she can't do it. But it was so close to the wedding that food's there, wine's there, guests are starting to arrive. So my brother had this crazy idea. He said, we should go ahead and have a wedding anyhow. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, it sounds like, you know, your family and your friends are still going to go to this thing because they've rented the cabins.
Some are probably flying in.
Some are already there. So you should be around family and friends. Let's go have a weekend out of it. He said, plus you paid for everything. So I did. I went up to Sea Ranch and had a full wedding weekend. And of the 150 people I invited, 75 showed up. So basically my side of the aisle. And we had the golf tournament on Thursday, and we had the rehearsal dinner on Friday, and we drank every ounce of the wine. And it was a surreal weekend. I mean, my head is spinning. Like any emotion you can think of, I was experiencing, you know,
You were in your own movie.
Man, I was, you know, suspicious. Was she seeing somebody else? I was depressed. I was embarrassed more than anything, you know, having to call 150 people and say, you just got dumped at the altar. But it really helped to have everybody around me. You realize how few times in your life you get that, right? So I was feeling a little bit better about my situation until the next week when I went back to my job as a lobbyist and I got dumped at my job. So the two loves of my life in a matter of a week, gone.
If I were your agent, I'd probably say this is contrived and not, this would not happen in real life.
I wish. I would have paid good money for it have not to have happened in real life. Unfortunately, it did. Mm-hmm. And so then I decided, all right, A, this is a bad week. B, I want to go on my honeymoon. And I had bought these tickets to go to Costa Rica, right? All expenses paid, you know, first class. So I asked my brother to join me. And he said, whoa, 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 whoa. Honeymoon suites have one bed, right? And I love you. And I want to help you out, but there ain't no way I'm going to spend, you know, 2 weeks in a honeymoon suite with you. And I said, don't worry about it. And so I convinced him to go with me on my honeymoon. And he had just been divorced, right? So here we are, two brothers dumped on my honeymoon. And this is going to sound weird, but it actually felt okay in that we had drifted apart, you know. And so we started to have talks. We never talked. And we started to rebond as brothers and to clear our heads and you know, talk about life. And so at the end of the 2 weeks, we decided to extend it for 2 years in 53 countries. Quit the job, sold the homes,
wow.
Cell phones into the ocean, and then just kept honeymooning around the planet. And it's funny, run into people and they'd say, you know, in Africa or Asia, and they'd say, hey, you're on a vacation? And I'd say, no, I'm on my honeymoon. And then they'd look at my brother and they'd say, what happened? So I decided one day to write what happened. And I love travel for 8 million different reasons, as do you. But one reason I love travel is that it allows you to tap into hidden passions. And you actually have a little time to, you know, draw butterflies or try to find the perfect margarita. For me, it was writing. I'd spent a career writing for other people, most of it meaningless. Most of it, I couldn't tell you, you know, one word. I wrote a lot of press releases and speeches for politicians. And
you were a governor's press secretary?
It seems like a different lifetime ago, but yes. And it seemed like I wrote the same press release and same speech year after year after year. So it was nice to be on the road and to have a little free time. I started to write about what it was interesting to me, and it was a soccer match or backpackers or the world's worst cab driver, which is a guy named Douglas in Trinidad. And then one day I wrote an article called Honeymoon with My Brother, and in it I said, I'm on a honeymoon, and I haven't set foot into one expensive shopping boutique. It's because a funny thing happened to me on the way to the altar. And I sent it out, and I had some friends who were in the media who said, oh, that's a funny story. You mind if I print that story? And I said, yeah, no, please, you know, take out the swear words, clean up any typos, and don't pay me anything for it, because I didn't want it to feel like a job. Mm-hmm. And so that led to some more articles and some more interest, and then some reporters started to contact me and said, hey, you know, that's an interesting story, these two brothers honeymooning around the world. And so we had some interesting coverage on that. And so at the very end of the honeymoon, when I was broke, I got an offer to go back to my old job. And I just thought, you know, yeah, that'd be an easy thing to do, but felt like I was in a different path. As you so well know, travel changes you. And the deeper the travel, the longer the travel, the more meaningful the travel, the more meaningful the change. And I felt like I was on a different path. And so I said, I want to write a book. And now I'd never written a book before, but I felt like I had one inside me. And I sat down and I took a lot of the articles I wrote during the honeymoon, and I wove a narrative about getting dumped, about honeymooning around the planet with my brother, sent it off to all the publishers, and then promptly got rejected by every single one of them. And for the dumbest reasons, things like, you know, the niche is too crowded. And I'm thinking, guy gets dumped at altar, goes on honeymoon with brother niche? You know, what niche is that? I've never seen that book.
So you created your own new niche.
Well, to this day, my books are in the most random places.
And yeah, where do you find it?
In independent bookstores. My books are normally in travel. Barnes & Noble, they're in memoir. Mm-hmm. In Borders, rest in peace, I was in self-help.
This is optioned for a movie now, right?
It was optioned for a movie, and then had a screenwriter who wrote an awful screenplay about it, and now we're back to square one. So, Tom, what are you doing?
Really? We need another option. I love it.
But I finally got a woman to say yes on my book, and it was an editor at St. Martin's, and she had edited such books as Men Are From Mars, Everything I Know and Learned in Kindergarten, which is a great book. Mm-hmm. And she...
How did you find her?
Well... Out of desperation, my agent contacted her, and the timing was great because she had a son, senior in high school, just been dumped. And this, she said, this boy came back, and it was like a whole nother person emerged. All these emotions started pouring out of this kid, and she said she felt like it was a new kid coming out. And she said, your proposal hit my desk that day.
Timing is everything.
And I said, oh, God bless your son. God bless the woman who dumped your son. Because she bought the book as a result. And so I spent another, you know, half a year refining it and editing it. And then it came out, and an interesting thing happened. It got some good media, but the book clubs really grabbed it and had fun with it and did things like sent us pictures of a, hey, we read your book at our book club. And they sent me a picture of a wedding cake with like a groom on the top and a bride fleeing off the side. And then they would invite us to their book club gatherings. And my brother and I said, okay, we'll go. So we loaded up his VW van and we spent 4 months crisscrossing the country. And anybody who invited us into their home or their church or their bar or their, you know, hair salon, we went. And we had a blast with it. And
in the process, that's what I understand made it a bestseller.
That's what did it. We were on Oprah and we were on the Today Show and some big media, and that was great. That helped. But what really made the book kick into another gear, you know, were the book clubs. Mm-hmm. And just a nice word of mouth. God bless the book clubs. To this day, if any book club out there calls me, I am there. I will go if I'm in the same area code, and if I'm not, I'll call in.
Okay, before we go any further, I want to see the movie, but since I can't see the movie yet, you need to share with us, read one of your favorite passages.
Sure. I think I'm going to read a passage called This Poor Old World of Ours, and you and I were talking about how travel changes your views on so many things. And one to me was the notion of poverty. And in America, we tend to paint it with one brush, just kind of a woe is me brush. But there's so many different aspects to developing worlds. And sometimes having a little less can actually be a benefit. And so this section goes like this. The boy entered the bus in Zambia holding his mother's hand. He wore a blue dress shirt, fraying at the cuffs and collar, dusty black shoes with no socks, and ripped black jeans, probably handed down. The other passengers stared out the windows, but he stared at his shiny new belt, constantly fidgeting with the buckle. When he stood, I saw the belt wrapped around his waist once and then almost again. Holes had been punched into the leather to shrink it to the size of his small frame. This was a belt meant to last many years, the boy's cherished possession. He was well off by Zambian standards. His mother could afford a belt and a ticket on a bus, and most of his countrymen aren't as fortunate. We left the upscale hotels and safari lodges in Botswana and South Africa and ventured into Zambia and Malawi overland. They're some of the poorest countries we've seen on the trip, and we've seen many, including Cambodia and Syria, parts of Bulgaria and Indonesia, slums in Brazil, Russia, Thailand. In fact, if you limited me to just one adjective to describe the world, I'd use poor. A friend emailed me during our stop in Cambodia. He wanted to know if the country was suitable for children, and absolutely, I responded, feeling it's always beneficial for kids to see their counterparts playing happily in front of one-room, tin-roof shacks. They can learn a lot from the poor. So can their parents. I know I have. They'd learn that a cold shower is better than no shower. They'd know what it's like to laugh and cry at the same time after a group of smiling, malnourished kids hugs your knee. They'd understand that the world isn't full of double espresso lattes, but powdered milk and boiled water. Ironic, but ask for coffee in a country famous for its coffee, Colombia or Indonesia, for example. You're likely to receive instant. The good beans go straight to Starbucks. They'd see that the toughest stairs can usually be melted away with a wave or a thumbs up sign. They'd see that in most of the world, children don't tease each other as much as about their clothes, and adults don't nitpick a friend's wardrobe. Just having clothes far outweighs irrelevancies like color clashes or seasonal choices. That old man with a hole-filled sports coat worn on a 90-degree day isn't trying to be fashionable. It's probably one of the only pieces of clothing he owns. They learned that most third-world citizens view employment as gold. Rarely hear somebody say the words, "not my job." They'd understand why people around the third world don't become angry when a car breaks down or a village loses power. They'd know they're privileged just to have them. They'd see that offers of food or drink are rarely refused, even if the food is half-eaten or removed from its wrapper. It's never considered impolite to offer nourishment. They'd understand the constant struggle to stay clean in streets without pavement, feet without shoes. They'd also experience a new type of humor. I asked a van driver directions to a hotel in Lusaka, Zambia. Up there, he said. I'll take you for 1,500 quetzal. No, thanks, I said. I'll walk. It's only a couple blocks away. Okay, he said, only 500 quetzal to walk. They'd recognize that poverty doesn't automatically equate to unhappiness. Some of the biggest smiles we've seen have been in areas where people have the least. They'd know that their mother was right, that there are people starving in Africa. Eat your vegetables.
Wonderful. I understand that you teach writing.
I do. I teach individuals and companies and
brands. I remember
brands.
You taught at Cal Poly, extended ed?
Yes, I've done some, and I'm still teaching over there as well as some private lessons as well, but I get a real high out of helping somebody get the story out. And I feel like a lot of people come to me and they say, oh, I got this really good story inside me. I know it. I'm just having the hardest time getting it out. I really love working with somebody, whether it's...
You do some of it online?
I do a lot of it online, and I do a lot of it in person, and I do a lot of private workshops as well as classes like through Cal Poly.
I understand that you've done book number 2. Tell us about that.
Right. So my publishers called me after Honeymoon with My Brother started to do well, and they said, hey, we need another book out of you. And I said, no. I'm done getting dumped at the altar. I'm done spooning my brother. Next time I go on a honeymoon, I want it to be somebody not related to me. And they said, nah, you know, write whatever you want to write about. So I said, okay, I want to write about love. And they said, huh? And they said, what authority do you have to write about love? And I said, well, I'm a professional dumpee, right? So they said, okay, here's $20. You know, go travel the planet with this $20 and do a book about love. And because to me, when I hear a country's name, the first thing I think are the people. And the thing that interests me most about the people in these countries are the relationships. The same things that we focus on here. It's like, how do people meet? How do they fall in love? What are they looking for? What's their ideal mate? And so I spent a year crisscrossing the globe with my brother just talking to people about love. And we picked a bunch of countries in India, Egypt, Nicaragua, New Zealand, Czech Republic, and just asking people, you know, what's love to them? Tell me about your love life. And met some really wonderful folks along the way.
When you recount and revisit all the different stories you were told, what one first comes to mind?
There was a woman in India, and during this book, I actually met somebody, right? I fell in love. And so now all of a sudden, my questions have stakes, right? They have, and I kind of...
Not theoretical anymore.
No, it isn't theoretical at all. It's very much hands-on, and I kind of realized that I know nothing about love and that everything I thought was true, the opposite's true. I'm kind of the George Costanza of love. And I remember talking to a woman in India, and she said, I don't understand the American version of love, and that you see your wedding day as the height of your love. She says, you see it as a finished mansion, but that's crazy because if that's the height, you can only go downhill from there. If it's a finished mansion, it can only, you know, peel, the paint will peel and the yard will go and it needs repairs. She said, do me a favor, when you get married, don't see your wedding day as a finished mansion. See it as a vacant lot, and that way you'll pick up a shovel and get to work.
And this was a woman in India.
Yeah, and it's true. And it's one of the reasons why they believe in arranged marriage. They see that love is something that comes through time and effort. It's not something that you fall in love immediately and that's it, everything is great. They see love as something that requires a little work. So yeah, if you can work at a relationship, you're much better off. If you're coming into it thinking, hey, this is going to require a little effort out of me, as opposed to, you know, oftentimes here we say, oh, I met my soulmate. It was love at first sight. You know, all right, talk to me 20 years from now after you've, you know, been married for 20 years. You know, I don't know any couple out there that hasn't had to work a little bit. Life's hard, you know, and you're going to struggle. But instead, you know, we talk about rekindling our relationship or getting back to that day. Whereas I really like her focus is see it as day one. That way you'll put a little bit more effort into it.
Another story.
Another story. Yeah, so I ended up meeting somebody during that book, falling in love, proposing. She said yes. And best of all, she showed up to my wedding.
I was going to ask you that next.
Although she was late.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love it.
She was 15 minutes late. And it was the same people who were at my runaway bride wedding, or my practice wedding, as my wife calls it. And they're laughing. And my brother and I, we were on Oprah. And Oprah asked Kurt, you know, what were you thinking? And Kurt said, honeymoon two. Mm-hmm. She showed up, thank God.
And you're married.
And we're still married. And we have a couple of sons. And I'm turning them into travelers, whether they like it or not. We tend to spend as much money as we can on trips rather than stuff, things. I think a trip is the best gift that you can give a kid.
Those are lifetime memories too.
And you know, for me and my wife, we sometimes see the payoffs down the road. Like we'll plan out a big trip and we'll go somewhere. We'll ask the kids about it, and maybe they'll say, oh, you know, that hotel that had a great pool, you know, that was my favorite part of the trip. And we're like, ah, we could have stayed here in San Luis Obispo. But then later on, you'll see a movie that takes place in France or in Brazil, or you'll read a story in the newspaper, and they'll say, oh, yeah, that's right. Soccer is a big deal down there. Remember we went to that soccer match, or remember we saw the people doing capoeira on the beach, or we went to Notre Dame in Paris. And you'll think, okay, I've planted some pins inside of you or a seed, and maybe it's taking a little while to blossom, but I think it eventually does.
Franz Wisner, an absolute pleasure to be with you.
Right back at you. I'm looking forward to more conversations ahead and more trips ahead.
We're going to do part two, Deconstructing Franz Wisner in the Near Future. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Cayucas, California. Thanks, Franz.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.